Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I agree with my friend from Sony that this Court does not have jurisdiction to review the agency's decision to institute the later filed IPRs. Yisom tries to get around the Acades case by saying that what is really being reviewed here is the final written decision as to claims that were not in the proceeding until the second petitions were instituted and the proceedings were joined.
And just very basic, is the office's position that may join a party, two questions, that may join a party can be the same party that's already instituted, and is the office's position that may join a party necessarily or at least allows that additional claims will be asserted by that party?
Yes, Your Honor, to both questions. Okay. On the first question, it says may join as a party any person who properly files a petition. And while join as a party would suggest ordinarily that it's party joinder that's allowed, but it does, the statute goes on and tells the director to evaluate the propriety of the petition that's filed, look at it and decide whether or not it's something that could be instituted, and if so, the director can join the proceedings. And so it's...
I'm maybe beginning to understand this. It seems to me, and tell me why this is wrong, that 315C is about joinder of parties to instituted review number one without instituting review number two. Because if you instituted review number two, there'd be no role for the joinder provision. Everything could be consolidated. So the only function of 315C is to allow a party whose request to institute proceeding number two, could be different party, could be same party, not my point here, does not in fact have that second one instituted. Otherwise, it would all just be consolidating two perfectly properly instituted proceedings.
I think that 315 is a little bit circular in that B says only if you join under 315C, and 315C says it doesn't apply if...
C does not require the second proceeding to be instituted, only that it be one that the director determines meet the non-timing requirements for institution.
Right, but it says that the purpose of 315C is to let someone who is otherwise time-barred under 315B get into the proceeding. And the director looks at that petition and decides whether or not it's institutable. And although Your Honor is correct...
So the joinder here maybe even should not have been coupled with the institution of the 326 and 327 proceedings. What role is played by the institution of the 326 and 327 here, as opposed to simply joining Sony to the 318 and 218 and 219?
The joinder of the institution of the second petition allowed Sony to bring forward different arguments about different claims that would otherwise have been time barred.
It strikes me as odd that the statute would have done that. I mean, I can understand joining a party who delayed in instituting, who's challenging the same claims, but why would Congress have wanted to frame this in a way that somebody could bring in new claims that would otherwise have been time barred?
The reason for that is that the patent owner is in an IPR proceeding, and there are it knows its patent is in jeopardy, and it allows either the same party, if new claims are asserted against it, or other parties to get involved in the proceeding and bring their claims against the same patent into the single proceeding that moves forward. So the patent owner has all of the challenges that all parties have against its patent resolved in the single proceeding. And the reason that we think that Sony can join into its own proceeding is because the statute just says any person who properly files a petition, and the way we read it, that allows other parties, and the way Senator Kyle in the legislative history says, it allows other parties to bring in new issues. And if other parties can bring in new issues, the statute is ambiguous as to whether or not the same party can, and we've interpreted it in a way that allows...
doing this interpreting?
It's been interpretation through the board by the agency.
Where does the board give an interpretive authority?
The director
and by the board here, I mean, you know, the 8 million possible three-judge panels plus how many other five-judge panels that result after the director or his or her delegee decides she doesn't like the result of the original panel.
Right. So the director has delegated the authority to decide institution decisions to the board. And in that, to get to Your Honor's earlier question about Allopat, it's especially appropriate in this situation that the director be able to make sure that her policy judgments are enforced by the board. And so it's particularly appropriate in a situation like this where the director has the ultimate authority.
Well, what happens to expand if another board tomorrow or yesterday decides it a different way?
If another panel were to decide...
They're not bound by the interpretation given by the particular panel that decided this case, right?
No, none of these decisions has been made precedential at this point.
Because I don't at this point, know of any other individual adjudicatory multi-member panel board decisions outside the PTO context where non-precedential decisions have been given Chevron or other kind of deference?
I'm not aware of any cases where non-presidential decisions have been given Chevron deference, but I
think
there
are cases that where non-presidential decisions have been given Chevron deference, but I think Judge Toronto's point is none of those cases involve multiple entities that could make the decisions.
Right, I mean, it seems a little bit peculiar given the sheer number of permutations of three-judge panel opinions that Congress meant to delegate to each one of those the ability to interpret its statutes, and particularly where it hasn't done so through a process that makes it binding on the agency.
I think that Mead suggests that whether or not a particular decision is made precedential does not matter in the Chevron inquiry as long as the agency does, in certain circumstances, consider its decisions binding. And there are precedential decisions. The board is...
But here there's no dispute. These aren't binding on anyone, right?
That's correct. This decision...
Okay, so what kind of deference are you advocating that we give to these individual non-precedential board decisions?
Well, first of all, I'd say that our position is that this court lacks jurisdiction to review the decision at all, so there's no question of the level of deference it should give. But I think the agency is showing that it is, in fact, using its best efforts to speak with one voice and to have aberrant decisions.
But Congress sort of said how the director is supposed to speak with one voice, but through a delegation of initial decision-making authority to any number of possible three-member panels of APJs, none of whose decisions is binding on anybody else, without notice and comment rulemaking or any other formal process, that's a little odd.
It may be a little odd, Your Honor, and I would point to Microsoft v. Proxicon, which says that even if it is, in fact, a little odd, it is an appropriate thing for the agency to do is through case-by-case adjudication, reach the result it wants to reach.
Yeah, but we're talking here about the level of deference of the office, the position of the government with respect to what deference is owed to this particular board decision, with assuming we can review, assuming it's reviewable. What level of deference is owed to this particular panel's decision with respect to what joinder means?
Well, I understand Yism's argument is conceding that Chevron deference would apply unless, in its view, the agency has been acting very inconsistently. And my response to that argument is that we agree that Chevron deference should apply, and we think that the agency is doing its very best to speak with one voice, and there's really only one outlier decision, the Skyhawk decision, and there are over 20 decisions involving joinder.
And any time there has been a seeming other outlier, you've engaged the power to reconfigure the panel so as to get the result you want.
Yes, Your Honor. The
And you don't see a problem with that?
Your Honor, the director is trying to ensure that her policy position is being enforced.
The director is not given adjudicatory authority, right, under the under Section 6 of the statute that gives it to the board.
Right. To clarify, the director is a member of the board, but your Honor is
right,
correct.
Right. But after the panel is chosen, I'm not sure I see the authority there to engage in case-specific re-adjudication from the director after the panel has been selected.
Well, that's correct. Once a panel has been set, it has the adjudicatory authority and the director has
to be... Until, in your view, it's reset by adding a few members who will come out the other way.
That's correct, Aaron. We believe that's what
happens. Who determines whether a decision is... I mean, if a decision were designated as precedential, then all other board panels would be bound by it, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Who makes that determination?
It is a somewhat complicated process where the board holds a vote and it has to... Someone has to bring it to the board's attention. It can be the board itself or someone from the outside requests that a decision be made precedential.
Why wouldn't the PTL make some of these decisions precedential, which seem to rest on broadly applicable issues such as joinder? Why are we faced with non-precedential decisions on these that kind of issue?
I think that the agency is considering making more decisions precedential. It's a slow process.
Does the director have authority to do that? Does the chief administrative law judge? You mentioned a vote. Do 250 board judges get to vote on what's precedential?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's
seriously,
it's a complicated process, and the a majority of the judges have to vote to make the decision precedential. Then the chief administrative patent judge decides whether or not to forward the decision to the director, and the director has the ultimate authority to decide whether a decision is made precedential. And
I think that sounds somewhat cumbersome.
It does seem somewhat cumbersome.
But in the absence of a precedential opinion, then if a board comes up, any way they go, you're saying one board decides joinder one way, another board panel decides it another way, and we're supposed to give Chevron deference to every one of them? If that's the way it works out? I mean, either Chevron deference applies in this circumstance or it doesn't. So if there are two different opinions, coming out different ways on joinder, we're supposed to give Chevron deference to each of those?
Your Honor, it's
the answer is no. Got to be no. Right?
It's particularly complicated in this case because the agency's position is that if the statute is ambiguous, the judges who come out the other way say the statute is unambiguous, and so Chevron wouldn't apply. But I don't mean to challenge your Honor's question.
Well, we got a lot more panels going on. We may get one that says it's unambiguous. It's ambiguous, and we go the other way too. I mean,
that's possible, Your Honor. And what the agency would do in that case would be to exercise its authority to try to bring that panel's decision in line with the agency's view.
Can I ask you one other question? I think I know the answer. This is about 315B. Has the director or any board panel said, has to do with claim filing versus patent filing. So if an IPR challenges a particular claim, whether the one-year period can be measured from when that claim was alleged to be infringed in court, even if infringement of the patent was more than a year ago?
Yes, Your Honor. The 315B says goes to the entire patent. And so if any claim in the patent has been asserted
and neither the director nor panels one way or the other have said, well, actually, it makes more sense to construe that timing rule to run from the time that the challenged claims were asserted in litigation.
No, Your Honor. The board has consistently held that it is required, that it affects the entire patent rather than claim by claim.
And so under that view, the fact that in the Delaware litigation filed by Yissom, there was no identification of claims is completely irrelevant to whether the 315 bar applies. In fact, the 315B bar did, in fact, bar the 326 with the...
Yeah, 326 and 327.
326 and 327. They were simply out of time.
Well, under the first sentence, Your Honor is correct that the petitions were barred, but the second sentence takes that away when a joinder decision is made. So it says the bar no longer applies when a joinder decision is made. If there are no further questions, I'll pass on. Thank you.
All right, we went over.